Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it's October 26th. This is the last day of practicums. There's got one more class with practicums, then you're all done. I don't know when the next test is. I could go take a look, but we're in the central nervous system, so I'm just going to continue with lecture. Does anybody have any questions over central nervous system? Okay, what are the two parts of the central nervous system? The two structural divisions, brain and spinal cord. Yep. All right, so then you got to know the different parts of the brain, some functions of those different parts. What's the largest part of the brain? The cerebrum. Yeah, and they're broken down into two parts, the cerebral hemispheres. Anybody know what separates the cerebral hemispheres from each other? The fissure, the longitudinal fissure. Very good. Okay. Then we started talking about spinal cord last time, and remember, spinal cord goes down to about the division of L2, and then what do you have down below L2, inferior to L2? You don't have spinal cord anymore, but you have a bunch of nerves. What do you call all those nerves that have left the spinal cord, but they still move down through the vertebral canal? And it reminded somebody of an animal. The cauda equina, right? The horse's tail. Okay, so what level are we looking at here on the slide? Can you see that? Oh, good. It's available for you to see. Fantastic. So is this below L2 or above L2? It's above. Plus, you can tell me something else. What level is it in terms of the vertebral column? Yeah, it's cervical because you see the nice transverse foramina, bifid spinous process. Okay. Now, there's a difference between the brain and spinal cord. In the brain, the cortical matter is gray, but in the spinal cord, the cortical divisions or the cortical regions is white matter. The deeper regions are gray matter. So there's a little bit of difference. All right, and what can you tell me about white matter? Myelinated axons, right? Myelinated axons going someplace, what we call a tract in the central nervous system. So in the periphery, the superficial regions of the spinal cord, these are tracts, and they're either going to be motor tracts or sensory tracts. Which way are signals being, which way do they move if it's a sensory tract?
To the brain.
So they're going up, right? Motor tracts are going down. All right, but nonetheless, those signals have to enter or leave the spinal cord to get out to the periphery, or if it's sensory, to get into the central nervous system from the periphery. And the only ways in and out of the spinal cord are via roots. And I see two roots. Here is a dorsal root, and here is a ventral root right here. And these roots are just one-way traffic. They're either 100% motor or 100% sensory. They're never mixed. All right, if a nerve is mixed, it's carrying both sensory and motor information, but these roots are one or the other. They're either motor or sensory. And you can tell just by their location. This dorsal root right here is always sensory, and this ventral root is always motor. All right, so you just have to memorize that. Or you could think of the architecture in the brain. Okay, for instance, the frontal lobe, what's the function of the frontal lobe? It's motor, right? And that matches up with the root as well. So this anterior or ventral root is motor, and sensory, like the occipital lobe, is posterior or dorsal in the brain, and so this dorsal root is going to be 100% sensory. Okay, and then you have tracts that either go up, that ascend to the brain, or tracts that go down in these various regions. And again, it's mostly arranged the way the brain is arranged. So let's look at the next slide to know what some of these things are called. All right, so in the white matter, right, these different spaces are called funiculi. One space is called the funiculus. So here is the ventral funiculus. These contain mostly motor tracts. And in the dorsal funiculus, these contain mostly sensory tracts. So these are where signals go up and down over here. These are where signals are descending. That's not always the case, but that's a pretty good idea. And then over here is the lateral funiculus. So a funiculus is what? Is white matter. It's a bunch of tracts going someplace in the spinal cord. All right, but not only do you have white matter, you also have gray matter in the spinal cord. And these bulges are called horns. So here we have the dorsal horn. Over here you have the ventral horn, and in some parts of the spinal cord you have the lateral horn. And in a couple chapters we'll see where this lateral horn plays a role, but you can tell easily that's a lateral horn. And then you have some separations of the right and left parts of the spinal cord. You have a fissure that is anterior, so here's the ventral median fissure, and then posteriorly you have the dorsal median sulcus. I really don't know why one was called a fissure and the other called the sulcus. I would have preferred if they were just both called fissures, because a fissure is what? It's a deep sulcus going through some part of the central nervous system. And so even this dorsal median sulcus is very deep. Okay. So there are signals, though, that have to go from the right side of the spinal cord to the other so that it can control your body, because you have an arm on one side, you got an arm on the other. And here is a pathway where information can be shared between the right and left sides of the spinal cord, and this is called the gray commissure. So anytime you hear that term commissure, you should think of pathways in the central nervous system where signals can go from left to right, like from the right hemisphere into the left hemisphere. Can you remember a part of the central nervous system, the brain in particular, that is loaded with commissural tracts, for instance, so that the right hemisphere can share information with the left hemisphere? The corpus callosum is a really good example. That's the largest part of the brain. But there's also an anterior and posterior commissure that probably you should be able to label for the quiz next time in lab. Okay, unless you still have your practicum later today, you don't have to take the brain quiz. But next week, there's a brain quiz. Okay, so the funiculi contain tracts, and these horns contain nerve cell bodies and dendrites of mostly multipolar neurons. So maybe you have a picture in your mind what a multipolar neuron looks like. So here we have some roots. Here is the ventral root, here's the dorsal root, and then they bifurcate into little rootlets right here. Right? These rootlets will converge to form a root. And then notice that the two roots join together to form a spinal nerve right here. So what's the function of this spinal nerve? Is it motor or sensory? Is it motor or sensory? Ah, but beware, it's a trick question. And somebody said both. Yeah, it's both, because it's composed of what? Both the dorsal root and ventral root. So a nerve does carry two-way traffic, but that's because it's loaded with neurons. Even though one neuron can carry traffic only in one direction, a nerve carries sensory and motor fibers together, all bundled together in different funiculi. Okay, so here's a spinal nerve. What else do I want to say? Oh, you can see something. You can see some connective tissue layers that surround the central nervous system. These are what we call the meninges, and it covers the brain as well as spinal cord. I can see the three main layers. The dura mater is the toughest layer, and that's how it got its name. It's the durable layer, the dura mater, the most superficial. The next layer right here is called the arachnoid membrane. I don't know if I don't see it. Do I see it labeled anywhere? I don't see it labeled. Here's the arachnoid, right? And then there's another connective tissue layer right on the surface of the brain, and it follows every little gyrus and sulcus, and this is the pia mater. That's the most delicate connective tissue layer that surrounds the brain and spinal cord. The last thing that I see on this diagram right here is a bulge. All right, so we see the spinal cord right here, which is part of the central nervous system. And what's the function of this dorsal root right here? What's the function of a dorsal root? It's sensory, right? It's sensory. And can anybody remember what kind of neuron is used for afferent signals, for sensory signals? It has a certain shape. What are the three shapes? You got multipolar, you got unipolar, and yes, pseudo-unipolar, and bipolar. Okay, and one you find in sense organs like the eye, which is the bipolar. So this can't be a bipolar, but this is sensory. So what kind of neuron by shape, right, makes up this dorsal root right here? It is the pseudo-unipolar, right? And this is the region right here that contains all of the cell bodies of that pseudo-unipolar neuron. So there's a process that comes out over here. We call that the peripheral process of a pseudo-unipolar neuron. And then this would be the central process that enters the central nervous system. And the cell body that contains the nucleus of those cells is located in this dorsal root ganglion. Now, why do we call that a ganglion? Okay, it's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, but it's a ganglion because it's outside the central nervous system. If there's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites inside the central nervous system, we don't call it a ganglion, we call it a nucleus, right? So there's another meaning for nucleus. Nucleus is in the CNS, ganglion is outside the central nervous system. All right, so that's pretty good for spinal cord. Let me just review our notes right here. Yeah, so we talked about all of this. All right, and I want to give you some examples of tracts. So let me put this back over here. I got two examples of tracts. Spinal thalamic tract. All right, so your appreciation of muscles will help you realize okay, something about these tracts right here. So when a muscle is named by its origin and insertion, what part of the word has the insertion in the name? It's the last part of the name of a muscle is the insertion. And what's the first part? That's the origin. Okay, so when, like sternocleidomastoid, the sternum is the origin and the mastoid process is the insertion, right? So you don't have to memorize all your muscles. Some tracts in the spinal cord are named by what their origin is and where they go. So here is a tract, right, that I can see, and look at the arrows. Which way are the arrows pointing? Up. So what kind of tract is this, afferent or efferent? It's afferent. It's a sensory tract. All right, and so where does it start? In the spinal cord, and where does it end up? It ends up here in the thalamus, so this is the spinal thalamic tract, because it starts in the spinal cord, and it ends in the thalamus. So let's take a look at this in particular. I'm going to have to zoom in. I can't show you this whole picture all at one time. All right, so here we have some pain receptors, right? So these are just somatosensory receptors on the surface of your body. They could be temperature, right? Or they could be other kinds of pain receptors. And so here is a neuron that brings that electrical information, nerve impulses, toward the central nervous system. So this is what we call what? A sensory neuron or an afferent neuron. And what's the shape of the cell that you see right there? Let's really zoom in. Does that look like a multipolar? No. Bipolar? No, that's a pseudo-unipolar neuron. And there's the cell body right underneath the cursor right there, and it's located in the dorsal root ganglion. And is the dorsal root sensory? Yeah, so this is a good diagram. It shows you that. So here's the peripheral process. Here's the central process. It comes in via that dorsal root, and it ends, it synapses in the gray matter, and here is the cell body of a second neuron. So sometimes we call these sensory neurons first-order neurons. It synapses on a second-order neuron, and notice that it crosses over to the other side of the spinal cord through that gray commissure, all right? And then it gets into the funiculus over here and joins the tract, and it ascends all the way to the brain, all right? So both of these, here's the first-order neuron, there's the first-order neuron, and this is going to take information to the to a gyrus, all right? And it's either going to be the precentral gyrus or postcentral gyrus. So which gyrus do you think it could be? I don't know if you can remember from last lecture, the pre and postcentral gyrus. One is motor and one is sensory. Which one is motor? The one in the frontal lobe, the precentral. The sensory gyrus is the postcentral, so this is going to go to the postcentral gyrus. But before it gets there, right, from our lecture last time, all sensory tracts stop in the thalamus right here. All right, and then it's the job of the thalamus to send these signals to the appropriate part of the cerebral cortex for your appreciation. All right, so there's a second synapse in the thalamus. Remember, the thalamus is a relay station for sensory information. And then it stimulates a third order neuron that takes electrical impulses to the cerebral cortex, okay, in the somatosensory cortex, and that is what? The postcentral gyrus, because that's the afferent the gyrus. Okay, so you have three neurons. And you see these arrows right here. So what would you call this tract right here? Would this be a cortical spinal tract or a spinal thalamic tract? Spinal thalamic, because it goes from the spine to the thalamus. And remember, that thalamus is always a relay station for sensory information. Another tract that I want you to know something about, okay, is the cortical spinal tract. And let's look at the cortical spinal tract. Which way do you see arrows? And does that make sense, knowing the name? Yeah, it's a motor, right? It's an efferent pathway, an efferent tract, because the arrows are descending. It's taking information from the cerebral cortex out to effector organs in the periphery, namely skeletal muscles. All right, so let's zoom into this region right here. All right, so what's the part of the brain that controls skeletal muscles? Where do electrical impulses start? Is it the precentral or postcentral gyrus? Precentral, because that's the somatomotor cortex, somatic motor cortex, primary cortex, for motor control. So these cells send electrical impulses, not to the thalamus, because that's for what? Sensory information. But this is a myelinated fiber. It goes through right between the thalamus and the basal nuclei that I see right here. And this is what we call the internal capsule. And what color is the internal capsule? Okay, yeah, it's white, as opposed to gray matter. So in terms of the brain, it's either gray matter or white matter. And it's white matter because these axons are myelinated, and it passes through, goes down into the medulla. Okay, goes into the medulla, and it crosses over. All right, so one side of the brain controls the other side of the body, and then it descends through the cortical spinal, crosses over at the medulla, goes into the cortical spinal tract, all right, and then it synapses on an interneuron, right, which then excites a motor neuron. Now, how would you know this is a motor neuron right here if we didn't have any neurons, if we didn't have any arrows pointing right here? Because how is this axon entering or leaving the spinal cord? Which root is it? The ventral root, and the ventral root is 100% motor all the time. So this is a nice motor neuron, and you see it going to a skeletal muscle. Therefore, you know this is a somatic motor neuron, not an autonomic neuron, right? Just somatic motor going to skeletal muscle. All right, so those are two tracks that I want you to know something about. And it's not too hard to realize spinal thalamic, which way do signals go for the spinal thalamic tract? From the spinal cord up to the thalamus, right? So that's sensory. And cortical spinal is an efferent pathway because it starts in the cerebral cortex and it goes to the spinal cord. So that's pretty easy to see. All right, those are the two kinds of tracts. Reflexes are important. I think we talked about these before on the previous chapter. And I think these were even on the test last time, so I'm not going to show you any pictures of these. All right, but, reflexes require no conscious thought. They involve peripheral as well as central nervous system components. All right, and reflexes occur. Information is shared at the level of the spinal cord. So reflexes happen without your conscious thought as a result of that. So here are the components of a reflex arc, but I think I should modify this, because what does a reflex arc always start with, and what does it always end with? What I give you right here are the just the structural components, okay? But it all, a reflex always starts with a stimulus, right? And it ends in a response. So fill in your notes, right? So it starts with a stimulus. But in order for you to perceive some kind of change of energy in your environment, what does your body have to have? A receptor, right? So you got stimulus, then a receptor, and then how does that information go to the central nervous system? Via a afferent neuron, right? And then it passes by the dorsal root ganglion through the dorsal root where it synapses on an interneuron. What's another name for an interneuron? Association neuron. That's the only kind of neuron that is located completely within the central nervous system, right? Sensory neurons are partly in the periphery, partly in the central nervous system. Something's happening. I don't know what. Okay, they're fixed. All right, and then the association neuron makes up its mind what to do, maybe to contract a muscle, for instance, and it sends out nerve impulses via the ventral root, because that's the motor root, out a motor neuron to an effector organ. And what does an effector organ do? It produces a response. For instance, if it was a painful stimulus, then that would cause contraction of a muscle that would withdraw that part of your body away from that painful stimulus. Okay, so there are probably some good pictures of reflex arcs in this chapter, or go back to the previous chapter. Okay, one of the last things that we get to talk about in central nervous system are the meninges. We talked about it a little bit. They're the connective tissue layers that surround the brain and spinal cord. All right, and you saw the outermost layer was the dura mater. Then you have the arachnoid and then the pia mater right on the surface of the central nervous system. You have another really good diagram of the meninges right here. And this is a good exam figure as well. All right, so here I see the brain, like the hemisphere. So here's where the picture is drawn from. Right, so probably right somewhere around in the frontal lobe or parietal lobe. So here's the longitudinal fissure. And here I see cortical. Cortical what is in this region right here? What color is this? But you can't say brown. Even though it might look brown. You should say, oh, well, it's gray, right? So here's cortical gray matter, nerve cell bodies and dendrites. Now you know what it's like to be colorblind, right? Okay, so here is white matter. These are tracts going someplace, right? And then we have skin of the scalp right here. And then here is a bone of the skull. Let's call this the frontal bone. All right, so here is the frontal bone. And remember, there's a membrane that is on the superficial surface of every bone. What do we call that membrane that surrounds the bone on the outside? The periosteum. So here is the periosteum right here on the outside. But also, here's the other outside part of the bone, because this is the medullary bone. Here's cortical bone. So here is some more periosteum right here. And it helps make up the dura mater. So this is what we call the periosteal division of the dura mater. And it also is composed of another deeper layer right here that we call the meningeal layer. So if you have the periosteal and meningeal layer, you put them together, you get the dura mater. And that's a very tough membrane. It holds the brain in place, right, and protects the brain. We see in some parts of the brain where there's a separation between the periosteal and meningeal divisions of the dura mater. We see it right here, and we call that a sinus. These sinuses in the brain are not filled with air like the paranasal sinuses. They're filled with blood, and in particular, what does this blood look like to you? Venous blood or arterial blood? And we haven't talked much about blood and physiology, that kind of thing, but arterial blood typically is red colored because it's loaded with oxygen. And then when it goes to tissues, it gives that oxygen up and it turns to a more bluish color. Probably not that, quite that blue color. So this is actually a big, huge vein that's returning blood back to the heart. So sinuses in the brain are huge veins that collect blood from the brain, because the brain contains neurons. It doesn't really have room for veins, so they're placed on the outside between the periosteal and meningeal divisions of the dura mater. So this is going to be the superior sagittal sinus, because it's what, on the superior aspect of the brain, and it's right on midline, and so that's how it gets its name. All right, so that's the dura mater. Underneath the dura mater and touching the dura mater is the arachnoid membrane. Okay, right here. Then we have a space underneath the arachnoid membrane, and it's connected to the surface of the brain with via these connective tissue fibers right here, but it's kind of a thick space. And in this space right here, we have cerebrospinal fluid. So it's just a pocket of fluid right here. So the brain is actually floating in this cerebrospinal fluid, and that helps protect the brain, prevents the brain from compressing, and it helps float the brain inside the cranium. Right? And this is what we call the subarachnoid space. Because where is it located? It's located deep to the arachnoid membrane. So here's the arachnoid, so this is what we call the subarachnoid space. Oh, here it's labeled over here. Subarachnoid space, and it's filled with what kind of fluid? The cerebrospinal fluid. And we're going to talk about that in just a little bit. All right, so notice the dura mater does go down into the longitudinal fissure, and we call that the falx cerebri. So that's a nice strong barrier between the right and left hemispheres. All right, that's only in the longitudinal fissure. All right, but before I leave this slide, I just want to make sure that you see the three layers of the meninges. The most superficial is the dura mater. That's the toughest layer. Then you have the arachnoid. And then you have the pia mater that's right on the surface of the brain, and it follows every little convolution, right, or gyrus and sulcus on the surface of the brain. That's the delicate membrane. So there is something that produces that cerebrospinal fluid. Let's see if I can find it. Cerebrospinal fluid. I want to go over the flow patterns of cerebrospinal fluid. Okay. Cerebrospinal fluid also fills ventricles inside the brain. And here is a ventricle. It's off of midline. It's filled with CSF, or cerebrospinal fluid, and we call this the lateral ventricle. The lateral ventricle has a tissue that makes cerebrospinal fluid, and that's called the choroid plexus. I don't see it on this diagram, but choroid plexus makes CSF. Right, here's another ventricle in the brain. This is called the third ventricle. It separates the lobes of the thalamus and separates the hypothalamus. And it's a very thin chamber, but it's kind of elongated from anterior to posterior. The third ventricle also has choroid plexus. It produces cerebrospinal fluid. And then here is the fourth ventricle between the medulla and the cerebellum. I'm sorry, between the pons and the cerebellum is a better way of thinking of it. All right, so here's third, here's fourth ventricle. The lateral ventricles at one time used to be called the first and second ventricle, and that's why this one is called the third. But we no longer call this the first and second ventricle. We call it now the lateral ventricle with some different pieces associated with it. All right, so there's a flow of cerebrospinal fluid from where it's made. Where is CSF made? The choroid plexus, right? And so it can flow from the lateral ventricles into the third right here via these interventricular foramina. So here's a little hole in the brain that CSF can flow through into the third. And from the third, it can flow into the fourth ventricle via this aqueductus sylvius, or sometimes we call this the cerebral aqueduct. And then it flows into the central canal of the spinal cord. And I forgot to mention where that is, but that's right in the very center of what the gray commissure of the spinal cord. There's like a little circle right in the very center. So CSF flows down the central canal, and then when it gets to the bottom of to the conus medullaris, to the very tip of the spinal cord, it leaves the spinal cord and it flows back up to the brain on the outside through the subarachnoid space to the superior part of the brain over here. Let me just show you another view of these ventricles. Here's a lateral view of the ventricles. So here you can see the lateral ventricles, the third ventricle. How does fluid get from lateral to third ventricle? Through that interventricular foramen. And how does fluid move from the third into the fourth? Via the cerebral aqueduct. And these things can be plugged up, unfortunately, a pathologic condition. So the choroid plexus continues to make CSF, and so these ventricles get very large, and it compresses and even destroys the brain when that happens. That's a developmental condition. And the name of that condition is called hydrocephalus. All right, and so here is an individual that was not diagnosed with hydrocephalus in utero, was born with that condition. That's just a really unfortunate condition because you just can't live very long under these circumstances. But what's the amazing thing? What's the cool thing about this? It can be diagnosed early now with just regular prenatal care because they do ultrasounds. And the really cool thing is that those passageways can be opened, they can be repaired, or a tube can be put in from a ventricle down maybe into a vein to drain a ventricle, preventing the development of encephalitis. And that surgery is done in utero now, before a baby's even born. So that's really fascinating, okay? And so it prevents these developmental problems from happening. If we go back over here, here is a microscopic view of the choroid plexus. Right here are some of those ependymal cells that you had to memorize, and we said these ependymal cells line the ventricles, but they also make choroid plexus. In this particular region, I see a blood vessel, namely a capillary, which gives up fluid to the ependymal cells, and then the ependymal cells secrete it into a ventricle, maintaining cerebral spinal fluid. And that fluid is very much like plasma, the fluid part of blood, right? And it contains ions like sodium, okay, and potassium, and even some of nutrients like glucose. Now, why is it important that we have sodium inside the brain? Why is it really important to have sodium and, for instance, potassium? Why are these ependymal cells doing a really nice job by secreting the proper amount of sodium into cerebral spinal fluid and potassium? Because what are those things involved in? Yeah, those are all important electrolytes that maintain the proper electrical activity of neurons, right? So you learn something about depolarization and repolarization. So those ions have to be there. All right, let's look at this slide right here. So here you can see some choroid plexus in a lateral ventricle. Here you can see choroid plexus in the roof of the third ventricle, right? And here is that interventricular foramen, so that's a typical flow pattern. And then it can flow down into this chamber here. What's this chamber called? Or what ventricle is this? Between the pons and cerebellum, that's the fourth ventricle. The fourth ventricle, the floor of the fourth ventricle also has choroid plexus. So these arrows actually show which way cerebral spinal fluid is moving, okay, down the central canal. And then when it gets down to the conus medullaris, it leaves and then it flows back up through the subarachnoid space. And this is the item that I wanted to get to all along. And that is this villus right here. It's called an arachnoid villus. Where did the fluid come from that the choroid plexus uses to make cerebral spinal fluid? Where did it come from? Where did that all that water and electrolytes and everything else, where did it come from? It came from the blood, okay? And if you take fluid out of the blood, what's going to happen to your blood volume? It's going to decrease, and what happens to your water balance when we take fluid out of your circulatory system? You're going to lose water, right? So you'll become dehydrated. So choroid plexus just can't continually take water and electrolytes and fluids out of your circulatory system, right? This cerebrospinal fluid has to be returned to the circulation, otherwise you dehydrate. All right, and this is how cerebrospinal fluid returns to the circulatory system through this arachnoid villus right here. So this is like a complete circulation. So whatever fluid is lost by producing CSF, it's returned to your cardiovascular system so that you do not dehydrate or become hypovolemic, meaning reduced volume. Okay, and you saw a picture of that in the superior sagittal sinus, which was right here. You see these arachnoid villi? Here's one in right here. So what's the function of these arachnoid villi or an arachnoid villus? What does it do? It returns cerebral spinal fluid, which is in the subarachnoid space, back to the cardiovascular system so that you do not dehydrate. Okay, so that's pretty important. And remember, the superior sagittal sinus is just a big, huge vein inside the brain. Okay, and here I can see the superior sagittal sinus drains blood down, okay, to the sigmoid sinus, and then this sigmoid sinus drains it into a jugular vein that you have in your neck, which then returns it to the heart. Okay, the dura mater has some divisions that separate out different parts of the brain. Here's the falx cerebri that separates the right and left hemispheres. Okay, and the falx cerebelli separates the lobes of the cerebellum out, and the tentorum is the part of the dura mater that separates the cerebrum from the cerebellum. So when we start doing a dissection next week, we'll have to dissect these parts of the meninges away from the brain, and that's kind of tough to do because the dura mater is really tough material. And you want to be kind of gentle about it so you don't destroy the parts of the brain just by removing parts of the dura mater. Okay. So let's see. That's pretty good. So we're done with central nervous system. Well, here's an interesting figure, which I didn't mention. Choroid plexus makes about 0.5 liter of cerebrospinal fluid every day. You could replace that by drinking. That's not too big a burden on you, but it's a lot better if, right, that fluid is just returned to your cardiovascular system. Okay. All right, what about central nervous system questions? Anybody have any central nervous system questions? Got to know the parts of the brain, parts of the spinal cord. Okay, so that means then we can move on to peripheral nervous system. So let me get some of these things going. Peripheral nervous system. Sign in sheet is going around somewhere. Did that get started? Did somebody sign it? You got it up back there? Fantastic. Yeah. Yeah, to the blood, or you could say cardiovascular system, or back to the circulatory system. Either way, any of those would work. Oops. Okay, so peripheral nervous system. Where would you find the peripheral nervous system? What is it? It's neuronal tissue located where? Outside of the central nervous system. Okay, so starting with the dorsal root or ventral root, going out to the periphery, anywhere in the periphery. Ah, here it is. Okay. All right, so the functional organization of the peripheral nervous system, right, it could either be sensory or motor, right? So sensory is afferent. It carries signals from the periphery to the central nervous system. And furthermore, we can break the sensory division or the afferent division down into two general locations. If it goes to the surface of your body, like your skin, we call that the somatic division. If it's coming from an organ inside a cavity, a body cavity, then that's a visceral division, okay, from body cavities. Motor, on the other hand, okay, we should think of effector organs, right? And if it goes to skeletal muscle, that's what we call somatic, and skeletal muscle is voluntary control, while the visceral or autonomic nervous system goes to effector organs that you do not control, that are controlled automatically, like smooth muscle, heart, cardiac muscle, or glands. All right, so that's a nice functional organization. All right, in terms of structure, right, which is really the main part of this class right here, we have peripheral, sensory receptors, so we have sensors in our skin for pressure and temperature and pain, right? And then we have peripheral motor endings that control the release neurotransmitter on effector organs to excite them, like acetylcholine acting on skeletal muscle. And then we have nerves, nerves that enter or leave the central nervous system. There are some nerves that leave the brain, and we call those cranial nerves. There are some nerves that leave the spinal cord, and we call those spinal nerves. And it just so happens that there are 12 pairs of nerves that leave the brain, so you have 12 pairs of cranial nerves, but there are 31 places where nerves leave the spinal cord, so there are 31 pairs of spinal nerves. So where are these things located at? Okay. So here's a picture of the brain, and in yellow are nerves leaving the brain, going out into the periphery. So what kind of nerves are these going to be if they leave the brain going out to the periphery or bring information from the periphery into the brain? So you got two choices, either spinal or cranial. Yeah, so these are cranial nerves. And notice that there are 12 of them. Okay, so these are cranial nerves. On the other hand, if we look at this picture right here, right, here are some nerves that are leaving, okay, the spinal cord. So could these be cranial nerves? Nope, these are spinal nerves, and there are 31 of them. Okay, there are very few, let's see, you're going to have to know the names of the cranial nerves, all right, but there's only a couple spinal nerves that I want you to know where they leave the central nervous system. And it's by designation. Okay, they don't really have names, but it's by designation between what vertebrae they leave through the intervertebral foramen. So C1 leaves between the occipital bone and cervical vertebrae number 1. And this spinal nerve number 2 leaves between C1 and C2. And so if we count all of these cervical spinal nerves right here, okay, we don't have 7 of them. Like you have numbers of vertebrae, there are actually 8 because where's the first one? It's between the occipital bone and C1. Okay, so there's an additional one right there. All right, so what do we have? Peripheral sensory receptors. Okay, you have free nerve endings for temperature and pain. And some parts of the body you have special receptor cells, right, like Pacinian corpuscles, Meissner's corpuscles and things like that for pressure and vibration. Sometimes we classify peripheral receptors by their location. So exteroreceptors are sensing information on the outside of your body. Extro means outside, like external temperature outside your body, okay, pain, damaging stimulus coming from outside your body. Pressure and touch, these are all exteroreceptors. Interoceptors are located deep inside your body, and again, there could be temperature receptors, for instance, in the hypothalamus, right? That would be an interoceptor for temperature. And you can experience pain deep inside your body. We call that visceral pain. It's quite a bit different than somatic pain, and somatic pain is what generated from the surface of your body. Somatic pain is very sharp, and intense, and you can localize it. You know where it's coming from, whether it's your fingertip or your elbow, your right arm or left arm. Visceral pain, on the other hand, it can be very acute, can be very annoying, but it's not very sharp, right? And the other thing about visceral pain, sometimes you can't really tell where it's coming from. You just know that something is wrong in some region of your body. You can't localize it. Some other kinds of interoceptors produce a sensation of nausea or hunger or fullness after you've done eating. Okay, and then the last kind right here is a proprioceptor. Proprioceptors, I'm sure we talked about these, are located in muscles and in all joints, and they send to the cerebellum the tension that a muscle is producing, what kind of motion a joint is undergoing, what kind of angulation a joint is that, so that you know something about your body position Your brain knows body position even with your eyes closed. Okay, other kinds of receptors can be classified by the type of stimulus, like mechanoreceptors for touch, pressure, and vibration, thermoreceptor, and again, those could be intero or extroreceptors, chemoreceptors, for sensing concentrations or levels of chemicals inside your body or even outside your body. Okay, where might you have some chemoreceptors for sensing chemicals outside of your body? Your nose, your tongue, for instance. Yeah, good examples. Inside your body, there are receptors for glucose within the pancreas. There are temperature receptors in the hypothalamus. Okay, another classification would be photoreceptors. You know where those are located, okay, in your eye. And then nociceptors are receptors that they're kind of like pain receptors, so they monitor what we call noxious stimuli, so a stimulus that can damage your body. So that could be high acids or lacerations or anything of that nature. By structure, different kinds of receptors. Some of them are encapsulated. Some of them, you remember, they kind of look like little onions, like a Pacinian corpuscle. The same thing for a Meissner's and Ruffini's corpuscle. So these, when those different layers deform, that starts action potentials going to the brain for your sensation of deep pressure or light pressure or vibration. Non-encapsulated would be like free nerve endings for temperature and pain. Hair follicle receptors are just those nerves that you saw wrapped around hair follicles, right? And proprioceptors, these are found in muscles and in tendons and in joints, and they measure muscle stretch, for instance, or tension. So that's what I want you to know about those things. Peripheral motor endings, we look at the neuromuscular junction, and the neuromuscular junction is communication between a somatic motor neuron and a muscle cell. And so what do we call that structural and functional unit of communication between cells? It's a synapse. So neuromuscular junction is a synapse, and you learn that there are two different kinds of synapses. What are the two different kinds of synapses? Electrical and chemical. And so a neuromuscular junction is an example of which one of those two kinds of synapses? It's a chemical synapse, because the motor neuron has to release a neurotransmitter to excite a muscle. And can you remember what the name of that neurotransmitter is at the neuromuscular junction? It is acetylcholine, right? So I'm using that as an example here again. Okay. And so any kind of neuron that releases acetylcholine is called a cholinergic neuron. It's a cholinergic neuron. Okay. All right, let's go to these cranial nerves right here. Cranial nerve function can be categorized by one of four different types. All right, so this is not a neuron, but it's a nerve. A neuron can carry information only one direction. And which way does a neuron carry information, electrical information? From where to where? Dendrite to cell body, down an axon, right? That's the direction. But a nerve, right, is an accumulation of thousands of neurons. And some of them might be afferent neurons and some might be efferent. So a nerve is what we call mixed in most cases. Some of the cranial nerves are not. Some of the cranial nerves are either sensory or motor, and you'll see why in just a second. All right, so the four types are sensory. That's one division. All right, so some nerves are only afferent nerves. They carry information from the periphery into the central nervous system. And these are cranial nerves number 1, 2, and 8. These are for vision, touch, and pain. And that makes perfect sense. Like when in lab, you're going to see the optic nerve. That is a nerve that's carrying visual signals into your central nervous system so that you have the perception of vision. All right, some cranial nerves are somatic motor. So when I say somatic motor, where are they going to go? As opposed to visceral. Somatic means not into a body cavity, but to the surface of your body someplace, towards skeletal muscle. Right, so skeletal muscle is outside body cavities, and it's voluntary. So somatic motor has a connotation of what? Voluntary control of voluntary skeletal muscles in your body. And in particular in the head and neck. So these are the nerves. 3, 4, 6, okay, 11, and 12 are somatic motor. Some are parasympathetic. The most important parasympathetic nerve right here is cranial nerve number 10. Right, and it wanders around everywhere in the body. It goes to glands and smooth muscle and cardiac muscle. So what part of the nervous system is that goes to these effector organs? All right, we say it's motor, but is it somatic or is it autonomic? Okay, these are all controlled automatically in your body by your autonomic nervous system. And remember, the autonomic nervous system has two divisions. Parasympathetic is just one division, and most of the outflow of parasympathetic information leaves the brain via cranial nerve number 10 right here. Okay, so we've got sensory, somatic motor, autonomic motor, and then we have mixed. And mixed just means what? It's a combination of both afferent and efferent signals, so it's both motor and sensory. All right, so here we get to sort of a fun part of the class because we get to talk about mnemonics. And so here's a lot of information that you would probably have to go over maybe 1,000 times to memorize it, okay? And then maybe not even then, right? So a lot of times in science we'd like to come up with a mnemonic and memorize a mnemonic, and that helps us remember a list of things that really don't have an easy connection in your mind to make. Right, so a mnemonic is just a little saying, and the first letter of every word in a mnemonic corresponds to the first letter of that list that you're trying to memorize. So it makes it a little bit easier. Here's a website, medicalmnemonics.com. It's like a Google. You can type in cranial nerves and it will give you a whole bunch of mnemonics to help you remember the names and numbers of cranial nerves. Okay, and you should probably put the filter on there and not look at any of the X-rated mnemonics, all right, and say them around on campus. Just go with the regular PG mnemonics. That would be good enough. Or even better yet, once you see how a mnemonic works, make up your own mnemonics. That will make it even easier. Okay, so let me show you these cranial nerves once again. So here are cranial nerves. Let me move it over. All right, so we're looking at the ventral side of the brain. So what? Tell me the location of this part of the brain where I have the cursor. What is that? Anterior. Then over here is posterior. All right, and then I see these cranial nerves kind of lined up from what? Anterior to posterior. That's not too difficult. And that's exactly how they're numbered. The most anterior is number 1. The next posterior is number 2. And then what do we have? Number 3, and then what? 4, 5, right? So it's not too hard to know the numbers of these by location. This is a good exam figure for you to know, but it's pretty easy, right? Cranial 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way down to, what's the last cranial nerve? Number 12, yeah, because there's 12 cranial nerves. Now, what's not so easy to remember are the names of the cranial nerves. The first couple are real easy. So this one right here, right, we call that the olfactory nerve. And what's the most anterior sense on your face? Smell, right? And what's the sense of olfaction? Smell. So that kind of matches up. What's the next most anterior sense organ on your face? Your eyes, right? So that's cranial nerve number 2. So olfactory is 1, all right? Optic nerve is number 2. Oculomotor is number 3. Right, and then trochlear is number 4. So how are you going to remember the names of these cranial nerves? I see abducens here is 6. And look for cranial nerve number 10 before we leave this page right here. What's cranial nerve number 10? The vagus. And what did we say about cranial nerve number 10? It's noteworthy because it's a very important parasympathetic nerve. Right, so it controls many autonomic functions in your body through parasympathetic stimulation. Okay, so let's go back to our mnemonic. All right, so here is kind of a fun saying. And it says, on old Olympus's towering top, a Finn and German viewed, oh, I don't know what happened to the W-E-D, viewed a hop. All right, so that's a nice mnemonic that will help you remember the names of the cranial nerves, like olfactory, optic, oculomotor, trochlear, trigeminal, abducens, right? So here's an A corresponding to the A in this saying right here. All right, so what is this saying, what is this little mnemonic? Maybe if you don't live in Europe, it doesn't make sense. Okay. What is old Olympus? Olympus is a mountain. It's a big, huge mountain in Europe, right? And everybody knows Mount Olympus. And probably if I say it just like that, then you go, oh, yeah, I heard of Mount Olympus, because there used to be gods living on Mount Olympus, right? In mythology, anyway. So it's what? It's a big mountain with a towering top. And then a fin is what? What's a fin? It's not a derogatory term. A Finn is somebody that lives in Finland, right? And a German is somebody that lives in Germany. And this might be kind of a slur, but what do these people like to do? They like to drink beer. And what do you use to drink to make beer? You use a grain called hop. I think it's a grain, okay? So here are these two guys sitting on top of Mount Olympus, and they're looking down over all these fields of grain, right, just kind of enjoying themselves, and maybe they even took some beer up there with them, right? And so they're looking around. So, and on old Olympus's towering top, a Finn in German viewed a hop, and the first letter, like this A in and, right here, corresponds, and what word is that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, right, should correspond to cranial nerve 8, which is what? Vestibulocochlear nerve. Now you might wonder, well, what does that have to do with A? Okay, and that's because somebody renamed this nerve right here. What is this nerve important for? Hearing. Okay, so this used to be called the auditory nerve. That's how this A got in there. All right, but somebody figured out a way to simplify it a little bit, and now we call it the vestibular cochlear nerve instead of auditory nerve. Okay. And when we get into senses, you'll see, oh, here's a little and right here. You'll see why we now call it the vestibulocochlear nerve when we get into senses. All right, so use a mnemonic or make up your own mnemonic to learn these cranial nerves right here. What's another one? Abducens. What does it mean to abduct something? Yeah, move away from midline. And in lab today, you'll notice that we have a number of extrinsic eye muscles that control the motion of our eyeballs, okay? And you can move your eyeball laterally, not both at the same time, because what will happen? What did your mom tell you? What will happen if you do that? You could get stuck. Well, that doesn't really happen, okay? But you can move what? You can move one eyeball laterally, okay? And that's a lateral rectus muscle. And you could then tell me what nerve goes to that lateral rectus muscle. It's the abducens, which is what? Cranial nerve number 6. Cranial nerve number 6 right here. Causes contraction of that muscle, laterally rotates the eyeball. Okay? And that would be what? A sensory function or a motor function? Moving the eyeball like that. That's motor. That's an efferent function, right? So abducens is a motor nerve. So how are you going to remember which nerves are motor, right? Which ones are sensory, and which ones are mixed? And what does mixed mean? Both afferent and efferent in the same cranial nerve. All right, so here's another mnemonic, okay, by cranial nerve function. And here it says, some say money matters, but my brother says big bucks matter most. Okay, so here's a mnemonic. And S right here means sensory, M means motor, and B means both, right? So here's cranial nerve. What's the function of cranial nerve number 1? Sensory. What's the function of cranial number 2? Right, so we got what? Olfactory, optic, right? And then oculomotor, all right, that's not too hard. It's in the name. It's going to be what? It's going to be a motor nerve. It's an efferent nerve. And what about cranial nerve 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? Cranial nerve number 5. It is a mixed nerve. It has both sensory and motor components to it. Okay, so you can use that to figure out the functions of these cranial nerves. Now, one thing for sure you got to memorize in this class is cranial nerve number 10 right here, right? And we said that is what, the vagus nerve, and that's a parasympathetic nerve. One effect of parasympathetic stimulation is that it goes to the heart and it decreases heart rate, right? So you should just memorize that one. There's another division of the autonomic nervous system, and that's going to be in our next chapter we're going to look at. Besides parasympathetic, what's another division of the autonomic nervous system? Sympathetic. Does anybody, I don't know if we talked about this, but what's the relationship between parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system? Oh, I think we talked about this. They're going to be antagonistic to each other. So if the parasympathetic nervous system via the vagus decreases heart rate, what does sympathetic innervation do to heart rate? It increases. Okay? So that's just some things to remember. Okay, spinal nerves. All right, spinal nerves are always mixed because what makes up a spinal nerve? You have roots. You have the dorsal root and ventral root coming together to make a spinal nerve, and the dorsal root is purely sensory, the ventral root is purely motor. So you add sensory and motor together, and you end up with a nerve that is mixed. Okay, so what did we look at last time? We looked at the ventral and dorsal roots. Actually, I want to clean something up here a little bit. Okay, we talked about dorsal and ventral roots. And I guess I got a picture right here I can show you. So here's a nice spinal cord, and here's a dorsal root right here. Here's a ventral root. Here's a dorsal root ganglia. So this is how signals enter the spinal cord. This is how signals leave the spinal cord. And then this is the spinal nerve, which is what? A combination of both sensory and motor nerves. So this is what we call mixed. All right, now these nerves, both efferent and afferent, will break apart right here, and some of the nerves will innervate parts of your body that are posterior to your spinal cord. All right, so here's a nerve that's going behind your spinal cord, and this nerve right here goes and innervates everything that's anterior to your spinal cord. All right, so think of your body, and which part of your body is the smallest division? All right, the part that's behind the spinal cord or the part that's in front of it? The smallest. Where do you have most of your body? Behind your spinal cord or anterior to it? Yeah, the smallest part is posterior to the spinal cord. So this thing right here is really small because you don't have a lot of nerves going posterior to the spinal cord. But this division right here is very large. It's carrying a lot of nerve fibers because you have a lot of tissues and a lot of volume that needs control. So these things are what we call a ramus. All right, so here is the dorsal ramus that is carrying innervation to everything posterior to the spinal cord, and the ventral ramus is carrying nerve signals to everything that's anterior to the spinal cord. And what about the function of a ramus? Is it motor or sensory? And you could figure that out just by looking at the colors that we see of these axons in here. What color is a sensory neuron on this diagram? Blue. Okay, and what color is a efferent neuron? It's red, right? So you see the roots are purely afferent or efferent, but what about these rami? Right here, rami is plural for ramus. It is, what do we call it? It's both, okay, when it carries both afferent and efferent neurons, right, is what we call mixed. All right, so rami are mixed, a spinal nerve is mixed, but a root, including rootlets, are, right, just either afferent or afferent. They're not mixed. So that's pretty good if you can see that. Oh, here's another view of that. So here's a nice transverse section. And here is spinal cord. You can see gray matter and white matter. And then, I tell you what, let me zoom in to this region right here. All right, so now I can actually see the roots. What root is this right here? Dorsal, right? Because here's the back. Here's a dorsal root ganglia. And what's the function of this dorsal root? In one word, sensory, or you could say afferent. What's the function of this ventral root right here? Motor, or efferent. And then here's the spinal nerve. What's the function of this spinal nerve right here? It's made up of both the dorsal and ventral root neurons, so it's mixed, right? So it has mixed function. And then it bifurcates into this ramus right here that goes posterior to the spinal cord. And then, so this is what we call the dorsal ramus, and then here is the ventral ramus that is going to carry information to organs anterior to the spinal cord. And so since the function of a spinal nerve is mixed, the function of a ramus is also mixed, right? So it's mixed, 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 and then here either sensory or motor. Okay. A couple other things on this diagram right here. Let me zoom back out just a little bit. Click. Oops. Okay, this will help you when we get to, I think, the next chapter. Okay, so here's the dorsal root, here's the ventral root, here's the spinal nerve, and look at this little neuronal tissue over here. All right, notice the spinal cord, of course, courses superiorly and inferiorly, distributing electrical information up and down your body. This thing right here, right, performs almost the same kind of functions as the spinal cord. These are like little auxiliary spinal cords that descend and arise right next to the vertebral column, just outside these vertebral bodies right here. But these things are specifically for sympathetic neurons, which is one division of the autonomic nervous system. These are like little auxiliary spinal cords just for sympathetic activity. And what do you know about sympathetic activity? It balances out parasympathetic neurons, right? So activity in these regions right here would accelerate heart rate. So these things are what we call the sympathetic chain ganglia because they go up and down on either side of the spinal cord. And why do we call it a ganglion? Because it's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, and they're interconnected with each other between other ganglia that are above it and below it. And so there have to be ways that signals enter and leave this sympathetic ganglion right here. And this is where I'm going to start next time by talking about these rami communicantes right here. That's how signals get from a spinal nerve into the sympathetic chain ganglia right here. All right, so don't forget, find your sign-in sheet and sign in, please. Oh, dang, we're almost done with this chapter.